Welcome to some very famous people you've never really heard of. Bite-sized biographies of the famous, the infamous, and the quirky in less than an hour. My name is Philip D. Gibbons, and there is more information about me, this podcast, and a bibliography at someveryfamouspeople.com. There are also photographs of many of the individuals and items mentioned in this podcast. At the conclusion of part one of this presentation, there will be additional suggestions concerning further information about today's subject, Hiram Bingham, the real Indiana Jones, and the lost city of Machu Picchu. Now let's get started with our story about Hiram Bingham. In late July 1911, Hiram Bingham, a professor and academic from Yale University, set out from Cusco, Peru, in search of the ruins of the rumored last capital of the Incas, Vilcabamba. Vilcabamba was the sanctuary of the last Inca ruler, Tupac Amaru, and the indigenous opponents of Spanish conquest, finally vanquished by the invaders in September of 1572. Bingham was intent on following up rumors of fabulous Incan sites obscured by centuries of overgrown jungle and neglect. Following a route besides the Urubamba River, he eventually came to a remote hut owned by a local named Melchor Arteaga, who scratched out a living selling provisions to the sparse population in the vicinity and the few individuals just passing through. When asked about ruins, Arteaga pointed to the nearby ridgeline, but referred to this site not as Vilcabamba, but by another name Bingham had never heard of, Machu Picchu. On the morning of July 24, 1911, for a single silver Peruvian sole coin, Arteaga agreed to guide Hiram Bingham and another individual known to history as Sergeant Carrasco, a Peruvian soldier providing armed security to the nearby ruins. How remote this objective was became immediately clear when Arteaga soon left the path and entered the overgrown foliage that led to a makeshift bridge constructed of logs lashed together that traversed the Urubamba. From there, it was straight up through jungle, a steep path that incorporated steps and rungs cut into tree roots, Bingham and Carrasco frequently resorting to following Arteaga on all fours. With the sun eventually eliminating the early morning cloud cover, the group accessed a clearing 2,000 feet above their original starting point. Although Bingham initially did not think it possible, this location was actually the farm of a family that exchanged produce with Arteaga for the right to grow crops on the property. And this family, the Richartes, now visible in their small hut in the middle of the clearing, were quite apprehensive about Arteaga's companions, Carrasco in a military uniform, and especially Bingham, who at 6'4" tall, with an angular 170-pound frame, in his strangely shaped hat, safari jacket, and khaki pants, must have seemed like a visitor from another planet. The rifle draped over his shoulder was also indicative of a potential threat, the two men possibly intent on impressing local men into the army or investigating recent native attacks on outsiders intent on establishing outposts focused on the emerging and exploitative rubber trade. Luckily, Arteaga was quickly able to defuse the situation, explaining in Quechua that Bingham merely wanted to see the nearby ruins. With that, the Richartes served a modest lunch, and then, with Arteaga having had enough, designated their 8-year-old son as Bingham's guide to the actual ruins. The boy easily scampered through the prickly underbrush that hampered Bingham and Carrasco. Although some of the land was cleared for agriculture, Bingham's perspective was also obscured by the overgrown jungle that prevented any distant visibility. Still, the explorer realized that he was probably one of a few or even the only non-native to access this trail for hundreds of years. Finally, they emerged into an open area, the sugarloaf shape of Huayna Picchu dominating the horizon. At the base of this mountain, despite centuries of uncleared vines, moss, and trees, was a fantastic series of visible interconnected white granite buildings and structures that Bingham immediately perceived as the most spectacular Inca ruins ever located in Peru. As the boy led him through one archaeological wonder after another, he was not dissuaded from this belief. The precise design of the stairways, temples, fountains, and plazas rivaled anything he had seen, even in the completely refurbished Inca walls in Cusco. One last surprise awaited Bingham, the boy leading him to the ruins' highest vantage point and a unique construction he recognized as an Intihuatana, an elaborate Inca sundial. Any other similar structure previously destroyed by Spanish conquistadors. Bingham was elated by this discovery, but also by the prospect that its intact condition indicated that the Spanish had never accessed the site. He quickly photographed as much as possible, and with the sun descending, Bingham and his small entourage left the area and ultimately headed back to the Arteaga campsite. Although elated, Bingham wasn't quite sure what exactly he had stumbled upon. Answering that question would comprise much of the rest of his life. Bingham's journey to the middle of the Peruvian jungle was both complicated and circuitous. He was born on November 19, 1875, in Honolulu, Hawaii. His parents, already firmly established in the white Protestant missionary community of the Hawaiian Islands. His father, also born in Honolulu, Hiram Bingham II, was an ordained minister and a graduate of Yale University. Bingham's grandfather, Hiram Bingham I, in 1820, left Connecticut to serve as a missionary in Hawaii when it was still known as the Sandwich Islands. Bingham I forged close ties with the Hawaiian native hierarchy and was instrumental in changing local attitudes about alcohol and prostitution, which did not endear him to his fellow Americans in the rapidly growing whaling and sugar industries. Controversial, he was recalled by the board that initially sent him to Hawaii in 1840, ostensibly as a result of his wife's illness, but actually to keep him from meddling in local Hawaiian politics. Despite his wife's death in 1848 and his desire to return to the islands as a missionary, he was never reposted and died in 1869 in New Haven, Connecticut. Hiram Bingham II sought an even more remote mission on the Gilbert Islands with his wife, the former Clara Brewster, a descendant of the Mayflower Brewsters. He arrived there in 1856, but the indigenous population on the Gilberts was not enthusiastic about Christianity, and Hiram and Clara frequently returned to the missionary base in Honolulu, and the Punahou School, founded by Hiram Bingham I on land donated by Hawaiian royalty and subsequently run by Hiram Bingham II's sister. The school served chiefly to educate the children of missionaries serving in Polynesia. Hiram Bingham II shuttled back and forth between Honolulu and the Gilbert Islands, but in 1875, Clara became pregnant, and with her husband sick with dysentery, it was decided that another return to Honolulu was necessary. It was under these circumstances that Hiram Bingham III was born, and his parents never returned to the Gilberts. Instead, they moved into a home built for them by the mission and focused on the task to which Hiram II and his wife devoted the rest of their lives, translating the Bible into the language of the Gilbert Islands. Despite an upbringing in such a religiously austere environment from an early age, Hiram Bingham III showed little inclination toward a religious calling. In a household where the only permitted reading material was the Bible or hymn books, the Bingham child sought refuge in the public library and the works of Mark Twain and other popular secular writers. Accompanying his father on a trip to California at age 12 only confirmed Bingham III's desire to eventually flee Hawaii and anything having to do with missionary work. In 1891, when his family returned to the mainland to organize the publication of the Gilbertese version of the Bible, Hiram Bingham III, left their New York household to enroll at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. He did not fit in among New England's wealthiest and socially connected offspring. His clothes and necessity to work in the dining hall, underlining his family's lack of economic resources. But he did develop a lifelong inclination to avoiding the type of economic austerity that typified his early and teenaged years. Luckily, Bingham was able to avoid a collision course regarding his future when it was generally agreed that he should matriculate at Yale, like his father. Although exposed to the worldly pursuits of an undergraduate, which included dancing, card playing, drinking, and smoking, upon graduation, Bingham returned to Hawaii, but it was only a matter of months before he made it clear that he would not pursue life as a missionary. Instead, he got a non-religious job and saved enough money to move to San Francisco and the University of California, initially intent on a master's in sociology, but ultimately switching to history, graduating with high honors. From there, it was on to pursuing a PhD at Harvard with a focus on Spanish America, a highly topical subject in light of the U.S.'s recent military hostilities with Spain. That was not all Bingham was pursuing. While an undergraduate at Yale, he was introduced to Alfreda Mitchell, the daughter of Alfred Mitchell, a wealthy businessman with interests in the whaling industry. But the serious money in this family came from Annie Tiffany Mitchell, Alfreda's mother, the daughter of Charles Lewis Tiffany, the founder of Tiffany & Company. Annie, one of his four adult children and an heiress to his considerable fortune. Hiram Bingham managed to ingratiate himself with Alfreda, and despite her father's misgivings, fully aware of Bingham's very modest missionary background, the couple was married on November 20, 1900. Initially, Bingham's pursuit of his doctorate degree at Harvard, with a focus on Latin American history, seemed like a shrewd move, as Teddy Roosevelt injected the U.S. government forcefully into the region, especially in Panama. Bingham also took full advantage of his newfound affluence, traveling with his wife to Europe, upgrading his wardrobe, and living in a three-story Cambridge home purchased by Alfreda's parents, the house large enough to accommodate the family's servants, and by 1906, four children. Unfortunately, upon completion of his Harvard PhD in 1905, a possible teaching position at Yale came to nothing, and Bingham was only able to secure a temporary job at Princeton as a kind of assistant professor in history, a comedown from his former professorial ambitions. With a wife typically devoted to managing a household and raising her children, Bingham, a much more restless and adventurous sort, decided that he needed to take some radical steps to accelerate his academic and literary career. Motivated by his grandfather's memoir of his two decades in the Hawaiian Islands and his father's unique linguistic biblical translations, he decided that he would personally visit Central and South America, intent on acquiring primary sources concerning Simon Bolivar. He hoped to produce an extensive biography of an individual that he felt Americans would find heroic and relatable, the father of South American independence. But actually not really sure of how to implement such a plan, through New York Yale Club connections, Bingham met Hamilton Rice, a legend in his own mind type, who already had experience exploring the Amazon with an eye towards mapping the region. Rice, the already wealthy grandson of a former Massachusetts governor, agreed to accompany Bingham on an overland trek through Venezuela and Colombia. Both men decided it would take at least 4 months to pursue a route taken earlier by Bolivar, an expensive trip that required Alfreda Bingham's financial support. Persuaded by her husband and despite her parents' skepticism, Alfreda underwrote this expedition, and by January of 1907, Bingham found himself trudging through Venezuela on horseback. His five-month trek was eventually chronicled in a book entitled Journal of an Expedition Across Venezuela and Colombia, a publication that mostly sensationalized run-ins with both skeptical local officials and indigenous peoples allegedly intent on killing or even eating Bingham, Rice, and their small entourage. Upon reaching Bogota, Rice and Bingham split up and in fact never interacted again. collaborative cooperation between two such egotistical individuals impossible. Hamilton Rice eventually became much wealthier by marrying Titanic widow and heiress Eleanor Elkins Widener. In 1929, he offered to endow Harvard's Institute of Geographical Exploration with the stipulation that he be named its director. The university agreed. Bingham got some good news upon his return from Columbia. Yale offered him a graduate position as a lecturer in the field of South American history and geography. Not permanent and with a meager stipend, it again was not the prestigious academic position he had in mind, but it was a start. This position came from the direct intercession of Yale President Arthur Hadley, who believed South America was a region that deserved greater academic study and attention. Hadley, previously impressed by Bingham's enthusiasm, also encouraged him to continue his hands-on exploration of the region. The newly minted Yale academic needed little encouragement, planning another South American journey to coincide with his participation as a delegate at the Pan American Scientific Congress in Chile. After meeting with the rest of the delegation with President Roosevelt at the White House, Bingham spent some time with his father, who, after a stroke, had relocated to the East Coast. Bingham's mother had passed away already in Hawaii in 1903. Reassured that his father was stabilized, he headed to South America. However, on this trip, he avoided anything too rugged, taking trains wherever possible. After spending some time in Argentina and Bolivia, and interested in finding not only archaeological sites but investment opportunities as well, Bingham decided to take a detour into the interior of Peru. By this time, he had received a forwarded letter from his wife who informed him that his father had relapsed and died, but there was nothing he could do about that now. He disembarked first at Cusco, accompanied by Clarence Hay, the 24-year-old secretary to the U.S. Chilean delegation and the son of John Hay, the deceased former Secretary of State in the McKinley and Roosevelt administrations. Bingham was impressed by this unique city and its various Inca ruins, especially the fortress complex of Sacsayhuaman, comprised of gigantic granite stones, perfectly cut and fitted together without mortar. He was intrigued with tales of the origin of the Inca Empire and a lost city of the Incas, a final redoubt retreat in which the Incan Empire attempted unsuccessfully in the 16th century to resist their Spanish conquerors. Perceived by local academics and civil servants as learned archaeologists and explorers, Bingham and Hay spent several days gathering information about the region and the various legends of spectacular ruins, artifacts, and even gold concealed by the jungle which had long since swallowed up these remote sites. As to the exact origins of Cusco, the ancient Inca capital, and the growth of the Incan Empire, mythology traces the beginning of the city to its founder, Manco Capac, a demigod considered the first ruler of the Incas. One of the many nomadic tribal entities competing for territory in the region, Capac was said to be entrusted with a golden staff that, when sunk into the ground, indicated where he was to construct a temple honoring his sun god father and establishing the center of the settlement eventually known as Cusco. This temple was known as the Coricancha, and while much of Manco Capac's 13th century exploits remain unsubstantiated, the Coricancha became the Inca's most visible and spiritually important edifice in Cusco. This development paralleled the early 15th century ascension of the Sapa Inca, or Inca ruler, Pachacutec, who transformed the Incas from an isolated tribal entity into an empire that dominated much of Western South America. The Coricancha became a reflection of this dominance, its masonry walls eventually adorned with panels of solid gold. This literal golden era lasted approximately a century. By the time Spanish conquistador Francisco Pizarro's expeditionary force landed on the outskirts of Incan territory, the empire stretched for 2,500 miles along the western South American seaboard, incorporating parts of present-day Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, Argentina, Colombia, and Chile. Pizarro began his campaign against the Incan Empire on May 16, 1532, landing successfully at present-day Tumbes, Peru, in the northern part of the country. This was, in fact, Pizarro's third attempt at attempting to verify rumors of the incredible wealth of the Incas, information that had reached the Spanish settlement at Panama. His first two attempts failed, and local bureaucrats then refused to provide any additional resources for another expedition. Like most of his conquistador contemporaries, Pizarro was ruthlessly ambitious and exceptionally acquisitive. He had already participated in the machinations surrounding the arrest and execution of Vasco Núñez de Balboa, and he refused to be deterred by the governor of Panama's refusal to allow his latest enterprise. Instead, he sailed back to Spain and personally met with King Charles I, who was also Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor. Charles was impressed by Pizarro's descriptions of his expeditions, the assertions of great wealth in the yet unexplored southern regions, and especially by the samples of gold, silver, and emeralds that Pizarro gave him, promising that much more of these valuable resources would result from a successful undertaking. Charles agreed, ultimately because of his commitments to the Holy Roman Empire. It would be his wife, Isabel, who served as his regent in his absence, who signed the formal license allowing him to proceed with his mission, a license invalidating any objections in Panama. As he sailed along the Pacific down the northwestern coast of present-day Colombia and Ecuador, Pizarro ran into the usual issues that plagued his two previous expeditions: hostile natives and difficult logistics. But upon landing at Tumbes, he was made aware of an internal Incan political development that for him was a very positive omen. A four-year civil war between two half-brothers, each claiming the throne of their deceased father, had just concluded. The victor, Atahualpa, had emerged victorious over his half-sibling, Huascar, who he imprisoned, and Atahualpa additionally executed many of Huascar's family members, political and military allies. Thus, Pizarro would be facing an enemy that was both depleted after many casualties and not necessarily unified in their loyalty to the Incan emperor. Nevertheless, upon hearing of the appearance of a small band of strange, bearded, pale-skinned marauders, Atahualpa began methodically moving an army of approximately 80,000 warriors northward in the direction of the town of Cajamarca. Including himself and his four brothers, Francisco Pizarro commanded a detachment of 168 soldiers with a modest amount of camp followers who served non-military functions, including that of a scribe or a chaplain. Such a discrepancy would seem to render this invasion as comically absurd, but Pizarro had several assets that equalized such a mathematical disadvantage. Some of his men and all of his officers rode on horseback, the horse a bewildering and frightening creature that the Incans had never encountered, especially in battle. The Spaniards, completely protected by impenetrable armor from head to foot, were also brandishing pistols, rifles, cannons, and arquebuses, larger long-barreled rifles used in coordinated volleys that were extremely deadly. They used crossbows, pikes, swords, and halberds, a large axe topped with a sharp spike, in organized hand-to-hand combat that was also devastating to an opponent armed merely with Bronze Age clubs, slings, and primitive knives. Familiar with Cortez's conquest of Mexico and the ruthlessness that was used during this invasion of the Aztec Empire, Pizarro was determined to use whatever treachery was necessary to conquer his adversary. Lastly, believing their Christian religion was so righteously superior to any belief system prevalent among the indigenous heathen, the conquistadors maintained a practically fanatical faith in a god who could not possibly allow their defeat. On November 15, 1532, Pizarro occupied the town of Cajamarca, which was deserted, its inhabitants having fled or in hiding from the occupiers. In the distance, the Spaniards could see the vast Incan army's tents on the hillsides to the east. probably believing that the best defense was a good offense. Pizarro then sent a company of approximately 15 horsemen in the direction of Atahualpa's camp, intent on enticing the Incan ruler to a private meeting in which the Spanish conquistador fully intended to capture his opponent. Believing that the threat of death to Atahualpa would paralyze his opponent's huge fighting force, Pizarro was merely emulating the tactics of Cortes, who had dealt with the Aztec ruler Montezuma in a similar fashion. Pizarro's company was led by Hernando de Soto, eventually credited with exploration of the present-day American Southeast and one of the first Europeans to access the Mississippi River. Only in his 30s, de Soto already had a great deal of experience dealing with hostile natives in both present-day Nicaragua and Panama, although they passed thousands of native warriors on their way to Atahualpa's headquarters, these individuals remained complacent, most likely as a result of Atahualpa's instructions to allow them access, the Incan ruler curious about both their behavior, weapons, and especially the animals that they rode. When de Soto, on horseback, attempted to intimidate Atahualpa by rapidly approaching the enthroned ruler, this had little effect aside from the random guards who hastily fled, behavior that Atahualpa subsequently punished with execution. The Incan ruler quietly listened to de Soto's boast about his king and his god and responded positively to the Spaniard's request for a council with Pizarro. He agreed to travel to the central square of Cajamarca with his army, where the meeting would eventually take place. De Soto and his contingent were then sent on their way. Encouraged by this interaction, De Soto left without the realization that Atahualpa had already decided that these disrespectful, ill-mannered invaders were to be captured and destroyed. His only real concern how to implement this plan to allow for the seizure of all of the magnificent beasts they rode, animals he wished to collect and breed for his own use. Unfortunately for Atahualpa, he was relying too heavily on his mathematical advantage and naive in not perceiving the degree of treachery Pizarro would employ in their interaction. 24 hours after his invitation, Atahualpa entered the main square of Cajamarca, leaving most of his warriors outside of the city. Expecting a conference of some sort, his 6,000-man contingent were armed merely with ceremonial hunting knives. The Spaniards deliberately left the main square deserted, concealing themselves and their heaviest weaponry, including artillery and the surrounding buildings. Atahualpa's litter, carried by an 80-man honor guard, was so large that it restricted the access of many of his soldiers, who were forced to remain outside of the square, which only had two passageways. Confused by the complete absence of any welcoming party, Atahualpa called out to the Spaniards to step forward. Instead of de Soto or Pizarro, a Dominican friar named Vicente de Valverde stepped into the square with a native interpreter, began an oration known as the Requerimiento, basically a statement that pronounced the divine right of the Spanish monarchy to seize land and subjugate and even kill any natives who refused to accept such a proclamation, considering this as an affront to God's will. Such a proclamation was presented in opposition to those in Spanish society who considered the violence, theft, and destruction of indigenous peoples and their culture immoral. The requerimiento, a legal justification for such behavior. What happened after the friar concluded his remarks is obscured by the passage of time. One version has de Valverde handing Atahualpa a Bible, attempting to get the Incan ruler to acknowledge acceptance of the righteousness of the Spanish presence. Instead, Atahualpa is alleged to have hurled the book to the ground, the subsequent cry of Santiago, a signal to Spanish artillery and gunners to commence firing. The lightly armed Incans either quickly fled this terrifying onslaught or were mowed down by the hundreds, the compact nature of the square, a devastating killing zone. Pizarro emerged with a detachment focused on seizing the Incan emperor from his litter, an objective which was quickly achieved, with Atahualpa removed from action and confined in a nearby building under heavy guard. Pizarro's plan called not for the execution of Atahualpa, but for his manipulation, hinting that if the Incan complied with Pizarro's demands, he would eventually be released. The Incan also made a fatal miscalculation when he came to believe that the Spaniards were only intent on collecting as much wealth as they could plunder and would eventually leave him and his country alone. To that end, he offered to fill an entire room with gold and two others with silver in exchange for his freedom. Pizarro agreed and reassured Atahualpa even further by allowing him access to his wives and concubines and letting him issue orders to his generals and governors. In fact, the first of these orders was a command to bring as much gold and silver from Cuzco as possible and to allow Spanish emissaries of Pizarro to enter Cuzco and take whatever they wished. Within minutes of entering the Incan capital, these emissaries began removing all gold and silver artifacts and even began using crowbars to strip the Coracancha of its gold paneling, a development that both stunned and infuriated the locals. However, instructed that this was being done to aid in the release of Atahualpa, they did not interfere. These artifacts and materials were conveyed to Cajamarca, where they were immediately destroyed by being melted into gold ingots. The Spaniards' frenzy to seize gold emanated from the compensation they received, basically a percentage of what remained after the crown received its 20% cut. Pizarro and his immediate lieutenants got their piece of the action, and the remainder divided among the rest of the invaders, enough wealth to allow even the lowliest soldier a life of great wealth, as long as they survived the invasion. For 8 months, Atahualpa was confined but not treated vindictively. During that time period, he secretly ordered the execution of his half-brother Huascar, who after his defeat was still imprisoned in the region. Atahualpa did not want the Spanish to attempt to undercut his authority and attempt to install his sibling as the new ruler, and so Huascar had to go. Became clear to the Incan ruler with the arrival of another Spanish conquistador, Pedro de Almagro, and a detachment of an additional 100 men, that the Spanish had no intention of leaving, and when they ignored his request to be released after the agreed-upon amount of ransom was provided, he realized that he had been duped. Because Almagro and his men were not entitled to any of the recently acquired spoils, this group was anxious to head south to Cuzco in the hope of obtaining their own share of plunder. Before this expedition, Pizarro and company needed to decide what to officially do with Atahualpa, on the pretext that he had secretly ordered an army to liberate him and that it was bearing down on Cajamarca. They tried him for various transgressions, including polygamy, the murder of his brother, and idol worship, the verdict all but predestined. On July 26, 1533, sentenced to death by burning at the stake in the same square in which he was captured, he was given the opportunity to be baptized, which he allegedly accepted, possibly believing that his sentence would be commuted. He was then garroted with a rope and quickly buried in a secret location. The locals who gathered to watch the execution were overcome as if they were watching the crucifixion of Christ, the degradation of a ruler they believed to be imbued with divine power, utterly incomprehensible. Pizarro quickly headed south, hoping to capitalize on the disorganization of the opposition. Atahualpa's supporters emanated mostly from the northern portion of the empire, so the residents of Cuzco, supporters of Huascar, were subjected to mistreatment at the hands of their northern counterparts. Still, despite this ambivalence, a sizable force attempted to stop Pizarro's entrance to the capital, this pitched battle merely reinforcing the Incan inability to combat Spanish technological military superiority. The Incan commander, an adherent of Atahualpa, subsequently abandoned Cuzco and retreated back to his base in the northern part of the empire. Pizarro entered the capital unopposed on November 15, 1533. Along the way, his column was joined by a 17-year-old relative of Huascar, Manco Inca, who claimed to have fled after the Atahualpa faction prevailed in the Civil War and wiped out most of Huascar's inner circle. Realizing that the young man was perfect as a puppet ruler to convince the natives, of Cusco that Pizarro meant no harm and wished only to restore the region's former prosperity, the Spaniard conducted an elaborate coronation, establishing a rapport with both the newly installed Incan ruler and the residents of Cusco, while covertly again looting all of the valuables they could get their hands on. Eventually, recognizing the negative intentions of the conquistadors, Manco Inca escaped and established an independent Incan state, its capital, the remote city of Vilcabamba. He was killed fighting the Spanish in 1544, but the Incan resistance continued under several sons. It would take the Spanish almost 30 years, but eventually, in 1572, Vilcabamba was occupied. The son of Manco Inca, Tupac Amaru, captured the official end of Incan royal lineage and what was left of the empire. Tupac was hanged on September 25, 1572, in Cusco's main square in front of 15,000 mostly shocked inhabitants. By then, both Francisco Pizarro and Diego de Almagro were both dead, assassinated decades earlier by members of their rival factions, never able to reconcile over the vast riches of the former Incan Empire. The only consistencies in the Spanish colonizers who followed them would be the same greed, cruelty, and religious fanaticism. Almost 350 years later, in early February of 1909, Hiram Bingham, after viewing the remarkable Incan ruins of Cusco, especially Sacsayhuaman, became intent on visiting the site of Vilcabamba, the final redoubt of the Incan Empire and the now legendary lost city of the Incas. This was a detour from his previously planned mule ride from Cusco to Lima, but upon arrival in Abancay, Bingham was told of a fabulous ruin known locally as Choquequirao that required several days of travel through dense jungle and high altitude. Hay and Bingham decided to take the detour, especially after being told that they would be the first foreigners to have visited the site for centuries. Accompanied by two Peruvian soldiers, Hay and Bingham made the arduous trek to this unique site, photographing it extensively, taking measurements and recording information. Despite its local nickname as the Cradle of Gold, the location had been clearly looted of any valuables. Only months earlier, a local expedition had unsuccessfully used dynamite to attempt to extract any hidden riches. But Bingham did return to the U.S. with several ancient artifacts and several sets of bones, including skulls, that he decided to bring back with him. Bingham also returned with the notion that Choquequirao might be the famous last holdout of the Incas, but even his initial research indicated that this was incorrect. He ultimately became convinced that this location was actually in a much more remote location, but he was not in a position to return to Peru anytime soon. It was not until 1911 that he was able to follow up on his theories about the exact location of the lost city of the Incas. Thank you for listening to part one of this podcast about Hiram Bingham. Information for this podcast came from the books Cradle of Gold by Christopher Heaney and The Last Days of the Incas by Kim McQuarrie. There are also additional photographs, bibliographical and musical information at someveryfamouspeople.com. If you have enjoyed this presentation, please like us at our Facebook page, Some Very Famous People, and follow us on Twitter at Philip D. Gibbons. Subscribe to my YouTube page at Noblesse Oblige, and please tell a friend about bite-sized biographies.